Good evening. I'm Joe. I'm joined by my good friend Adam, and we're getting reacquainted after 20 years apart.
Hello, I'm Adam, and this is the religion episode, in which Joe and I discuss how far we have come or not come from our very similar religious upbringings. And Joe, I actually just want to start this episode with a small apology. Because back when I deconverted from Christianity, as the strange saying goes, we were still doing theocrats for a little while, our minor thoughts. Were we not?
We were.
Yeah. And there is a phase that I think most new atheists go through, and that is the anger phase of the process of transferring to a new worldview. So, I don't know, I remember you've logged a few, or you've saved a few posts from back in the day, and looking back at them, I just remember wincing a little bit and thinking I would not be that aggressive anymore. Again, it's probably a healthy phase, but I'm going to be much nicer this time.
Well, that's a load off my mind.
Yeah.
And I should state, for the purpose of the listeners, the last time we talked, we left off as we were finishing up high school. And during college, Adam and I started writing a blog together. Now, if I remember correctly, at the time, we were both raging Ayn Rand libertarians.
Hmm. Christian Ayn Rand libertarians.
Which was a very, very unique niche that mm-hmm. we occupied. We may still be the only ones that ever occupied that niche.
Yeah, it's no wonder that we got a few hits.
So we wrote a blog together called The Theocrats, the conceit of which was that we were libertarians who were going to be ruled by God, not by man.
Mm-hmm.
Did that for a couple of years, up to about 2006, I think, and then continued writing together for a little bit at minorthoughts.com.
Which is still up, and which you should visit.
It occasionally gets content.
Yeah, it is entirely Joe's animal now. He posts what he likes, which tends to be a series of reviews of books he's read and comments on news articles as he sees fit.
And the ever-so-occasional sports post, one of which may be coming in the next couple of days if I get around to it.
All still from a fairly libertarian perspective, would you say?
I would say so.
And this isn't supposed to be the political episode, but I've certainly moved to the left there, too. I'm not even sure if I would call myself... I guess I would call myself a moderate leftist at this point, but yeah, that'll be interesting, too. But for now, religion.
Religion. After all, if we're going to dive deep into what exactly happened to you, where else to start but that least contentious of topics, religion?
Well, you know, it's not so much about... I think it's the perfect place to start, because at least it should be that a worldview is a very holistic thing. You know, it's more than just one's religion and one's politics, but yet I think at the core of it is definitely an understanding of how the universe works and what's out there, and everything kind of follows from that, to at least logically, and logic doesn't always guide us, but it's certainly the place to start. So let's do I think I would be fair in saying that although you remain a Christian, your views on doctrinal matters have changed over the years, yes?
Yes, very much so.
So, for starters, I left you as something of a Calvinist Christian. Would that be correct? Would you say that John Piper largely... spoke for you?
I'd say that was pretty true, and that itself was something of an evolution from where I was in high school. In high school, pretty much entirely unaware of John Piper and unaware of really anything outside of the ultra fundamentalist circle that I grew up in. So it wasn't until I got to college and started learning more about the broader world of Christianity that I actually ended up running into John Piper.
Mm-hmm. I start at John Piper, I guess, because I think a lot of us, I think both of us, managed to lead fairly parallel lives for a while, as far as how we developed, theologically speaking. It's funny, looking back, a lot of, though, these schismatic issues in the Christian church were not ones that actually fazed me much. I've always thought that Arminianism, or the predestination versus choice, seemed fairly capable of being harmonized. And I still feel the same, which is one reason why it doesn't faze me much that, you know, if you break down my present view of the universe, that colliding atoms tend to make up a lot of destiny. It's because, regardless of whether, say, my love for Anna is based on some sort of spiritual connection or biological one, and these two interfacing minds, you're giving different explanations for the same thing. It's the same phenomenon. It still exists. You haven't shown it to be fake by giving it an alternative explanation. You see what I'm saying?
Right, I do see what you're saying.
And then in the same fashion, I don't think that individual will and predestination are mutually exclusive, at least not to an extent that matters. Really, it's science fiction. Is probably the best way to look at it. Or not science fiction. What is this? You would know better than I would. The test that determines whether a computer is alive or not, whether it can convince.
Oh, the Turing
you.
Test.
The Turing test. Exactly. You know, if a human being can convince you that he or she has a soul, then it's really irrelevant whether that person actually does. It has the equivalent is clearly there. You know, see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Perhaps a tangent, but I suppose there will be many of those because religion certainly is given to them.
Religion at times seems like just a collection of tangents that have been pulled together over time.
You joke, but. I have a series in my head of blog posts called What Comics Have Taught Me About the World, if you will. And I really want to write a parallel, a comparison of how after, say, 20 years of comic book issues in which Captain America does this and that and all the rest, and, you know, all these inconsistencies creep up within continuity. There's always an editor or a writer whose job it is to pull it all together and explain it in such a way that the story does not completely derail into nonsense. And I feel that authoritative decisions that are made occasionally throughout religious history, whether in church councils or what, are kind of the equivalent to that. That, you know, you kind of pull it back all together and make sense of it, whether you're coming up with an artificial explanation or whether God is guiding you as you wish, in order to move forward.
What Brother Hezekiah is trying to say is, and then insert an hour-long digression.
Yeah, exactly so. So I'm very much curious then, taking as our starting point this sort of very rigid Protestant Christianity, what has changed in the interim for you? What are things that come to your mind when you look back at yourself and think, oh, I really don't believe that anymore?
I would say the root underlying thing that's changed the most is I was very, very ignorant when I started college. And I should actually point out, I went to University of Pittsburgh, which was a secular non-Christian college. Mm. Actually, the opposite of you, as I understand, Shorter is a Christian college.
Yes.
A Baptist college specifically.
Yes. There's a very large asterisk next to that, but I don't want to derail your explanation. Please continue.
So I went to a secular university. Now, I'd grown up in one church tradition my entire life, and that was really the only form of Christianity I knew anything about. The Abeka curriculum, as much as I think it had its good points in other areas, did not do a great job of teaching all the different facets of Christianity, all the different subgroups and differing beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so I went to college knowing only what I had grown up in and nothing else.
Question, because you may remember better than me, was there any comparative religion there?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Or if there was, very, very little.
Yeah, I don't remember ever learning about Buddha or the Islam or anything like that, so I didn't know whether I just missed it or whether it wasn't there. Both seemed equally plausible. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, if anything was there, it was a mention that they existed, but nothing really of any substance on the beliefs,
mm-hmm.
Of other beliefs, let alone on other aspects of Christianity.
Sure.
So I knew the Catholic Church existed and had basically grown up with the belief that Catholics were not Christian,
mm-hmm.
Had been Christian at one point in time, but no longer understood true Christianity, and that if you saw a Catholic, you needed to work on converting them to true Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Same.
The same way Jewish people were viewed. If you found a Jewish person, it was good. They had the beginnings of the faith, but they certainly didn't understand the full story, and you needed to work on converting them as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I show up in Pittsburgh and join a campus Christian group called Christian Student Fellowship, which was a interdenominational group. So it had students in it from all different Christian backgrounds, Catholic, and about 10 different varieties of Protestant. And that was my first real exposure to, here are people who are Christians and who believe different things than I do. In some cases, subtle small things, in other cases, large important things, but it was a wake-up call of there's a lot I don't know that I need to learn if I'm actually going to sound intelligent and not going around insulting people.
Hmm.
And so that was, I would say, freshman year, sophomore year, into junior year, was really this whole process of discovery of what did these other Christians around me believe, and how was that different from what I'd grown up with. And I came away with a belief that Catholics, in fact, were Christian, and that more importantly, Catholics had a lot to teach Protestants, and that Protestants ignoring or demeaning the Catholic Church were missing out on a lot of good. The Catholic Church throughout history certainly has its faults, certainly has the places where it has made tremendous mistakes, but has a rich tradition of Christian thought, thousands of years worth of scholars thinking and writing about various aspects of Christianity, most of which is completely ignored by modern Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
And I came away with this understanding of the Christian world is much more massive than I had ever believed, has much more depth to it than I had ever believed, and has a lot worth studying. And also just that sense of history and tradition and continuity. I think we'd mentioned before that in the churches we grew up in, it was very individual. You went to a specific church, and that was a specific group of 50 to 100 people, and that was in some ways the true church, because every other church was subtly wrong in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so church history started when that church was founded and encompassed what that church believed, whereas you jump over to Catholicism and church history started 2,000 years ago and has a continuity from that founding all the way until now, where you can be a part of it and can feel that I am a part of something that is really ancient and really big, mm-hmm. rather than a part of something that is small and relatively recent. And just in terms of how I viewed Christianity and viewed being a Christian, that was a massive sea change for me.
It's interesting that you mentioned this part about. I mean, you're right that this that you know this you're either all these other people are Christian too, to whatever degree, or else you know this the church is your little community of believers in the United States of America, 2,000 years after Jesus. There was always this disconnect that my mind just kind of slid right over. But for me, there was this assumption that even though doctrine was not the official doctrine was almost never purely Christian throughout history, that, you know, the untold stories were everywhere, that, you know, real Christians were always around. They just weren't necessarily in positions of authority or what have you. It's almost like the modern queer history studies, if you will, the idea that, you know, gay people have always been around. And if they're not in history, it's just because nobody wanted to write about them. And I felt the same way about the true Christians, that there was a secret history running through the 2,000 years of the church.
Well, it's interesting when you apply that specifically to the Catholic Church, that you can point out all the ways in which the bishops and the popes were seeking after power and were getting in struggle with various kings and princes and barons, and even the squabbling that led to, I believe there was one point in history where there was at least two, if not four, popes simultaneously, as different parts of Europe fought over who was actually going to have that power. And that was what I grew up knowing before I went to college, and what I realized after I'd been at college studying this stuff a little bit was, yes, you had those areas, but you also had a lot of actually truly devout people who were sitting in monasteries this entire time, mm-hmm. and really thinking deeply, churning out documents and writings and treatises. And as you say, that true Christianity, the guys who aren't the power seekers just using the church as a power base, but the guys who actually care about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so you discovered, in a word, ecumenicalism.
And that led to a lot of changes in my actual beliefs. Church I grew up in was very much focused on a literal reading of the Bible. I'm sure you're familiar with this idea.
Oh, yeah.
Taking everything that is in the Bible literally and treating it as truth. Mm-hmm. And college was where I first started getting exposed to the idea that, no, there is biblical poetry, there is biblical wisdom literature. There is, in fact, a large part of the Bible that you can treat as literature in the same way we would treat any other writing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where the author is not intending to be taken absolutely literally. He is not saying that a person by this name literally lived and literally spoke these words. He's instead creating a scenario where he's trying to communicate a moral lesson or a way of viewing the world through a story. And that was, when I first discovered that idea, that was fairly mind-blowing that there were other ways to read the Bible where it didn't mean exactly what the words on the page would mean if you took them literally.
Could you give me an example or two?
I would say Job for me right now is an example.
That was actually the first thing I thought of. Like, I was curious as to your thoughts on Job and also Jonah.
Right. And Job, I don't think you have to take literally. I don't think there has to have literally been a period where Satan came before God and God and Satan made a bet and ruined Job's life over that bet. I think the point of the wisdom literature is let's posit a situation and look at it from 15 different angles, and how does that affect your view of what's going on with your faith when you're pondering it from all these different ways. In some ways, it is almost, dare I say, the biblical equivalent of science fiction. let us posit a scenario, let us posit a world, throw a bunch of stuff in it, and then sit back and think about the consequences.
Hmm.
In Jonah, I would say these days I have a very hard time taking Jonah literally, especially since I'm not yet aware of any periods in Assyrian history where the entire Assyrian nation repented of their evil ways and changed their stripes. The more I learn about the historical Assyrians, that seems, well, highly unlikely, which is part of the point of Jonah, is Jonah is asked to do something that seems absolutely nuts on the face of it, and then goes about having these adventures that are just as nuts, and then at the end goes and does what he's been commanded to do, gets the result that he never thought he would get, and then is ticked off that he got that result.
Mm-hmm.
So Jonah's always been a very interesting story to me there as well. You're commanded to do something, you try to avoid doing it, you do it, it succeeds, and you're super angry.
I heard a theory once that I really liked, that it is, that it's partly a comedy. That there are definitely moments when you're supposed to find the twists of events funny. And I can easily see how it would be that way, whether or not it is. You know, essentially Jonah throws the game as hard as he can. He gives the shortest sermon in the entire Bible. Just tells him real quick that everyone's going to die, so they better repent. And just lets that be the case. And what happens? The entire Assyrian Empire repents in sackcloth and ashes. You know, just
well, and you even get into the events on the boat where this massive storm comes up. Everybody is praying except Jonah, the only one who supposedly actually talked to God in this entire thing. Everybody but Jonah is praying, and they're all looking around trying to figure out who brought the bad luck on the ship. And then lo and behold, it's the Christian guy down in the hold, using the word Christian loosely here, who finally says, just toss me overboard. It's the only way to solve it. Just throw me over the side. And you get the opinion Jonah is looking for a little bit of suicide there, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of having to do the job one way or another. And instead, he gets swallowed by a whale. And yeah, you're right. There is a massive element of comedy, both in the fact that he gets swallowed by a whale rather than drowning, and then the fact that in the end he, like you say, preaches the shortest sermon ever and is then ticked off that it worked.
It's a good book. It's still one of the Bible stories I quite enjoy.
And actually, about that shortest sermon ever, he didn't actually call for repentance.
No.
I just pulled up chapter 3 to verify my memory, and he just goes through the city saying, 40 days and you're all going to die, 40 days and you're all going to die. And it's the people themselves that supposedly end up calling for repentance.
So what comes to mind next is your views on biblical inerrancy. I think imagining Jonah and Job as short stories, if you will, is not only perfectly fair, but also rather helps theologically, because otherwise you have to do some explaining. But there's a lot of that in the Bible. So what would you say your views are right now on the idea that the Bible is divinely inspired, and therefore, in one way or another, everything is completely right?
I think there I would go to a sermon series that was preached at our church here in Madison, oh, I don't know, 6-7 years ago at this point, where the pastor made a pretty big emphasis of, if we're going to understand the Bible properly, we have to keep in mind that the Bible was not written to us. The Bible was written for us as Christians to learn from, but we are not, and I say we as Americans sitting here in the year 2017, we are not the audience that the Bible was originally written to. It was written to a specific people at a specific point in time, living in a specific culture, in a specific political environment. And so you have to understand what's written there in terms of it being written to them. And we can, as it were, listen in on that mm-hmm. and learn from it. But we can't listen to it the same way we would listen to one of our contemporary peers mm-hmm. giving a talk. And so this idea of inerrancy, which I think delves into kind of the huge, massive question that always comes up, was there a literal six-day creation, or is evolution true?
That's a good example.
You know, because if you're going with literal interpretations and with inerrancy, you're saying, well, the Bible is saying there was a six-day creation, therefore there was a six-day creation because the Bible cannot be wrong. And during that sermon series, we actually had Professor John Walton from Wheaton come up and speak at our church. And he talked about Genesis as being a piece of ancient Near Eastern writing and having a creation story at the beginning, as a lot of ancient Near Eastern writings do, where the purpose of the creation story is to establish that your deity created the world and is in charge of the world, and that you have to look at the creation narrative in Genesis through that viewpoint, that is it is establishing that God created the world and God is in charge, but it is not a scientific text saying how God created the world. So it's not saying this happened on day one, this happened on day two, this happened on day three, as though God had a giant factory that was churning out everything that populates the earth. But rather it's saying there is order and a pattern to everything, that you see animals, God is responsible for all of them. You see plants, God is responsible for all of them. You see rivers and oceans. You see rain. You see people, God is responsible for all of it. It's not just random. So it's making a theological point about the world that we live in rather than a scientific point. And so I think when I think about inerrancy today, that's a lot of what I think about is the Bible accurate in the worldview that it's communicating, rather than is it scientifically or historically literally true?
Okay. I understand what you're saying. The logic of the inerrantists, is that actually a term? I can't remember anymore.
Sure.
Okay, we'll say. The logic of the inerrants. Okay, but if you can't say it, it's not a good term, maybe. proponents of biblical inerrancy consider the accuracy of the Bible important because otherwise it is not, in their view, an authoritative message from God. And it's hard to argue with that. To whatever degree it is correct about things, it's supernaturally endowed with timeless truth, you know, it's valuable. And to whatever degree it is using outdated ideas about the world to get across these concepts, it's doing less of a good job than something written today supposedly would. So why is it that we still listen to the old story instead of updating the mythology, I guess is what I'm saying. Am I making myself clear? Why is the Bible still the center of all the attention when it's, if it's not a message in a bottle?
I think you're making yourself clear. Why is it that we haven't come up with, maybe perhaps as the Mormons did, a new revelation that speaks to us today?
Something like that. Sure, let's go with that. Why is it that, I mean, as a historical artifact, I see the value. Let's remember that this is the oldest record we have of our relationship with God. Okay. But if that's become more and more outdated as a representation, then why is it holy?
I think that has maybe two things in it. Outdated as a representation, I could understand to be either that it's outdated in terms of representing who God is and what he desires from a Christian community, and also outdated in terms of just we're no longer a largely pastoral agricultural culture.
Mm.
Most of us are not in the Middle East, and so most of what's in there is unfamiliar to us. And the nations and the cultures that are spoken of are long dead and only dimly remembered. And I think as far as the second element, you're certainly right. It is very outdated in terms of we are no longer facing problems with Assyrians and Babylonians and Romans. In terms of representing who God is and what he desires from a community, I would say there's an argument to be made that because we don't have anything new, that part isn't outdated.
Is it the fact that everyone agrees that this is right that makes it holy then? That, you know, otherwise these future revelations are too diffuse and no one agrees on them?
That was basically where I was going to go next, was the Hebrew scriptures date from a rather large span of time, dropped into the narrative, as it were, every couple hundred years, getting a new deposit into the collection. And then there's the 400 years of silence between the last of the prophetic books and the Gospel of Matthew, where we've got nothing. And then the New Testament scriptures began appearing. And those went through a fairly involved process before what we consider the New Testament canon was actually established. You know, there was a lot of books floating around that made claims of being authoritative and made claims of being worthy of inclusion in the list, and some of them did indeed actually make the list, and many of them did not.
Some wound up in the Apocrypha or by the Orthodox Church.
Right. Different subgroups of Christianity accepted different ones, and then there's the list that all of the subgroups of Christianity accept. So I would argue it's not so much that there couldn't have been anything over the last 1600 years, as there just hasn't been anything over the last 1600 years that has won widespread acceptance.
Okay.
And so I would argue that it's not that there couldn't ever be something new, just that to date we have not seen anything.
So you would argue that the Age of Miracles essentially continues, but much like the true Christians of the secret history of the church, it's not necessarily getting a lot of press, or at least it's not capable of being firmly identified.
Right, not capable of being firmly identified, or perhaps we live in a very skeptical culture these days in the Western world. And I think there's an argument to be made that if you were to work a genuine miracle in our culture, you would get some people that would absolutely believe you, and you would get a lot of people that would be hunting around for the wires that must be hidden somewhere on the stage. Where's the trap door? Where's the box with the hidden exit? What made the illusion work? And so I myself am somewhat skeptical that miracles would actually be valuable in this part of the world, whereas perhaps in other cultures, miracles are still a way of actually affecting people. And so it happens off the grid, as it were.
Okay. What about morality? Because it seems to me that parts of the Bible don't age well with our current ethics. there is a general, you are a better thinker than most people, I think. You're capable of keeping multiple ideas in your head at the same time. Usually there's a cheat that, with regard to the New Covenant, Jesus is described as love, but he's also God. And if he is God, then he is also the Old Testament God. It is essentially the same person who is doing these things. And the only time he necessarily reveals that part of himself is when he sees the money changers in the temple. A little bit of it, the old nature comes back at that point. Loses his head maybe a bit. I'm curious as to how you deal with the dashing of children's heads on rocks and the general difficult parts of the Old Testament. When God, you know, is against things that you believe in now, freedom of religion, for example. When he orders the death penalty for all manner of things, and of course orders the genocide of the Canaanites. I'm not looking for a solid scholarly refutation here, and I actually have had the thought as we began this that although we have chided ourselves for not preparing much for this podcast, I think that's probably for the best, because it keeps us from looking up arguments and making lists of things. You know, I think it'll be more honest, and we'll just be sharing what goes through our heads.
As Dr. K.S. Wiley said, if you look at this particular passage from this particular standpoint...
Exactly.
No, it's a good idea. We're not doing that. Now, I would say where I come from personally is I'm not comfortable with everything that happened in the Old Testament. But then again, I'm not comfortable with most of what passed for normal everyday life in the ancient Near East during that time period. Much of just the day-to-day and what was accepted across a wide variety of cultures turns my stomach. And I think it is fair to ask the question of, if you're trying to work with a certain group of people and you're trying to bring them along and change what's going on in the world, and you're not doing it through shock and awe, appearing as a flaming 15-foot colossus bestriding the land, sitting in a literal temple, and issuing commands verbally. If you're not doing it in that sense, then you're going to be working with the people in a way that fits in with what they consider to be normal. You're going to be making tweaks. You're going to be steering kind of a rudder attached to a very large boat. You're going to be making changes, but it's going to take a while for those course corrections to actually show up and be seen. And there's much in the Old Testament that I can accept from that point of view. The dashings of the infants' heads against the rock, I believe, is if memory serves, a quote from Psalms. And that's either David or one of the other psalmists writing a polemical prayer, which I think would have been entirely a natural thing to write for that time period in that part of the world. So the fact that it's there doesn't mean that's what we should aspire to, but it does let us see perhaps the very real anguish and anger of the person who was writing those words. And so I think there's a tendency to want to say, well, if God was truly as moral and as just as he is, he would have stepped in and put a halt to all of that brutality. And I think it's really a question of, do you want to win people over to you by becoming that 15-foot colossus, or do you want to, as it were, woo them over gently? And so there's much in the Old Testament that I can look at from that point of view.
If the point of I've decided that I'm not going to counter argue or anything, but I have a further question about this. If the Old Testament and the New, if the evolution of morality that we clearly see throughout the Old Testament and New Testament is God, as the phrase goes, meeting us where we are, then can an argument not be made that modern morality is an improvement on the morality that is ordered by the New Testament?
In terms of, for example, modern views on homosexual relationships as opposed to Old Testament or even New Testament views on the same.
Yes. People like to say that Jesus had nothing to say about homosexuals, but of course Paul clearly had a much more dour view of it. Similarly, views on women in church, or Jesus is harsh words on a number of issues. Yeah, but, you know, just as you will.
This is a tough one to answer because some of my own beliefs in this area are still in a matter of flux, and I haven't fully decided where I come down, so I can't really give a definitive statement of, do I think modern morals are better, or that we should fully revise what's there in favor of what we feel now.
I'm not really asking for you to give a pronouncement ex cathedra. I'm just asking if you think that's a possibility, if you think an argument could be made for that.
Yeah, in that terms, I think an argument could definitely be made. I think there is room to argue that, again, Jesus was speaking in a specific Jewish culture at a specific time in a specific geographical place, and what would have been anywhere near the realms of acceptability for that period of time would be far different from what would be acceptable in our own time. I do think, as I look at the Old Testament, you know, especially relationships between men and women, I think you can make an argument, and I realize this is massively contentious, but I think you can make an argument that certain biblical New Testament models for how men and women relate has something attractive to it. In terms of the idea of helpmeets and people who occupy different spheres or help each other out in different ways, I think there are ways, absolutely, for that to be abused and turn into ugly situations. And I also think for couples that see eye to eye, there can be a very attractive way of interacting and using the biblical model as a way of splitting up roles and responsibilities in your own family and your own marriage. You know, I'm not going to be as hardcore as perhaps others might be and say that this is a model that absolutely everyone should follow and must follow. But I think there's an argument to be made that, no, you don't have to say that what we do now in certain relationships is the only way and the New Testament way is wrong. I think you can say that the New Testament way has its positives, shall we say.
A final question, I guess I'll throw out, because this is one of the issues that I found very difficult to surmount as a Christian, and I suppose it left me with a choice, and if nothing else, you could certainly argue that I made my bed for all the reasons that I'm accused of sometimes. What is your understanding of your duty as a Christian? And I ask this because Jesus has a lot of very radical things to say, and he's also very clear that this is hardcore, that there aren't many of them, that it'll be easier to fit a needle, be easier to fit a camel through the eye of a needle, than have rich people make it to heaven. There's And what you see in the world is that there are over a billion people in theory or that claim to be following his orders. And I just can't see it. I couldn't see myself doing it. It seems to me very much like Jesus had and was arguing for behavior that most of us would consider to be disturbingly cultish, or at least full-on bore today. Sell your possessions, go out, preach to all the world, fight, because the world's going to be ending soon. You know, there was this entire, the ethos, to my mind, of the Christian is radical. And so I feel it's, I have a really hard time, honestly, accepting that almost anybody I've met really qualifies. Not because they're imperfect. You know, we often, you know, say, you know, I'm perfect. I'm imperfect. I'm forgiven. But my point is really that I know very few people who even try, according to the blueprint that I see in the Gospels. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I think there are parts that it's very difficult to try to determine exactly what is meant. I think it's somewhere in one of Peter's writings that he makes reference to the fact that, paraphrasing liberally here, that Paul writes a lot of stuff that is extremely difficult to understand, and I'm still trying to figure it out myself, which I've always found hilarious, that you'd have Peter, one of the church fathers, saying, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff, and if you're asking me to explain it, I got nothing for you. And I feel that way sometimes when it comes to certain of the things that Jesus said, because when you think about it, we have a decent number of recorded words, and yet at the same time, what we have is obviously a minuscule fraction of what he would have actually been talking about over a 3-year period. And so I struggle to know exactly how we should be understanding it when he's talking about struggling and fighting and selling your goods. Is that something that's supposed to be a guidepost for everyone over the next 2,000 years? Or is it meant more specifically for the time period that the Jewish people were in with the Roman Empire, when in fact it wasn't that much longer after Jesus' time period when the Romans came in and sacked Jerusalem and tore down the temple, and in a lot of ways the Jewish world was ending during those Roman occupations and Roman attacks, and, well, let's be honest, Jewish rebellions followed by Roman reprisals. So is Jesus talking in a short-term sense about what he would have known was coming down the pipe? Or is he talking in a definitive sense for the next 2,000 years? And I don't know that we necessarily have enough recorded words of Jesus to be able to say. That would be a very interesting conversation, but I feel like we just don't have enough information to really answer that question. And so the question of, I think your original question was something, what do I see as the point or the aim of Christianity today? Or where I'm going with it.
Sure. What's the Great Commission, perhaps, if that's correct?
Yeah, I wouldn't say Great Commission, but I would say mission. For the last couple of years, I have been sticking with what Micah wrote in Micah chapter 6. And I'll just go ahead and read it, because I've got it up on the screen here. And one, I kind of like the language, and two, I think it illustrates it. Micah says, "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And that really speaks to that angle of, should I be selling all of my goods? Should I be completely sold out? Is that what's important? And Micah continues, he has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? And so I've taken that as my mission over the last couple of years of, there's a lot I don't know about what's supposed to be going on in the world, but I can focus in on working for justice in the area that I'm in, showing kindness to the people that are around me, and being humble rather than arrogant. And I interpret that as being humble rather than arrogant and controlling. Being humble and perhaps listening more than speaking. And so that's what I see as Christianity is, and I think this is something Martin Luther argued for as well. If all of those billion people around the world that claim Christianity were to all actually be looking to fight for justice where they are and showing kindness and acting humbly, I think we would see a far different world than we do. Do we each need to be doing grand gestures and leading massive crusades? Or can we, through the sheer power of numbers, make the world a better place just by living in a proper way? And so that's what I've been focusing on is, what can I do to live in that proper way, and how can I really seek to promote justice and to live with kindness?
All right. I thought of one final question to ask you, just because I think it's... we've spoken about morality within the Bible concerning what has happened in the past, and God has seemingly sanctioned. But there's also a larger worldview that I find difficult to get past concerning heaven and hell. So I would like to know where you believe people like me go after we die, if we versus where you go and why that is, or why that's acceptable.
End with an easy question, I see.
Yeah, and feel free to be conversational about this. I don't need a full treatise.
That is honestly a very difficult question, and one of those that I prefer not to think about too much, because the direction it leads in is not exactly pleasant. Because everything I can see in the Bible would say that, well, I'm destined for heaven, you're destined for hell, which is not an outcome that I think anyone would want for friend or family, and possibly not even for foe. I mean, you have to really dislike someone to look forward to that kind of an end for them. And I know there's been a number of pastors in recent years who have tried to argue that, in fact, love will win in the end, that no one will go to hell, that God will.
Rob Bell got big.
Yes.
Right when I was in college, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's an attractive idea. I can see why he got big. It's a very attractive idea to say, well, it sounds dire, but in the end, God's going to do what God's going to do. I don't know that I believe that. I think I would like to believe that. The part of me that was Calvinist for a while, and I'm not 100% sure I'm still Calvinist, the part of me that was Calvinist for a while would say that, well, God has ultimate control over who goes where, and if he wants to arrange things in a certain way and
do certain things with certain people. That's his prerogative. The part of me that rebels against all of that would say that, well, that still doesn't seem quite right, because after all, Adam's a great guy who seeks to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with his fellow man, if not with God. And so I think this is the point where I should be giving an impassioned plea to save your immortal soul. But that's never... Argue that I'm a bad Christian if you like, but offering impassioned pleas has never been quite my style.
I've often wondered if I'm not temperamentally unsuited to being a Christian as well, and that in itself led me astray.
Well, there is a certain element, too. I just want to be the guy who goes out in the morning and tills the soil and milks the cows and comes home and sleeps the sleep of the hardworking righteous and not have to worry about what goes on over the other side of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think an answer to your question where I come down is my longest held beliefs say one thing. What I want to be happening says something else. And it leaves me with a situation that I'm not entirely comfortable with. And that's about where that lies. I don't have a neat way to wrap that up and put a bow on it, but just a kind of hanging out there.
Okay. Got it. And I suppose knowledge-wise, you would argue that everyone has in some way, shape, or form enough knowledge to come to Christ?
That's the part where I express a lot of uncertainty as to the exact metaphysics of what goes on. Just because, again, the biblical writings we have are so... It seems like a lot, but it's so limited in quantity. You know, everybody quotes Romans, I think chapter 1, that the natural world provides enough evidence for God that anyone who has just seen the natural world is without excuse for not believing in God. But of course, that leaves a ton of questions unanswered, such as, okay, I'm a guy in a society that has never had the Bible translated into my language, has never had contact with Westerners, or Easterners, I guess, depending where on the globe you're standing. And I see the natural world, and I'm duly impressed by it with a sense of awe and of wonder. Is that sufficient, or do I have to have actually heard the name Jesus in order to be saved? And I don't think Romans gives a clear answer for that.
Well, beyond the matter of whether Jesus' literal blood or saves, prior to contact with Jesus, even if they get a get out of jail free card, aren't, I guess you're positing great swaths of the world, the vast majority of the world, not having contact with God, not having that same communal relationship as with the chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
Which in itself seem like they're not exactly getting a fair shot. or are being left out in the cold.
Yeah, and I think that's where I'm going for with that angle, is if you've got millions, hundreds of millions of people over 2,000 years who never even had the opportunity to hear, is God saying that they all go to hell, or does he indeed act differently in different circumstances? And I don't feel the Bible is specific enough for me to really take a strong position on that.
Well, if you don't feel that the Bible takes a strong position on people who have inadequate information receiving or God's feelings about people who do not have adequate information, does that ambiguity bleed over into people such as myself, who made a good faith attempt to know God and failed after strenuous attempts to convince themselves of his reality?
I would say no. I would say that I think the Bible would draw a distinction between people such as yourself who have certainly read all of the words, heard all of the sermons, seen, as it were, all of the evidence, and walked away not believing. I would say there would be a difference between that scenario and someone who was never aware of any of that in the first place. As much as I don't like the answer, I think the Bible is relatively clear that if you've heard and rejected, you're in a far different, far more dangerous state than to have never heard in the first place.
So what about, and I understand that you don't have hard answers to this because you are not God, but what about a person, Japanese person during days when the first Catholic missionaries were coming up, who hears about God but does not receive nearly enough education to make the case for Christ, as Lee Strobel would say, a compelling one in comparison to the far richer breadth of Buddhist apologetics available to him at the time. Sorry, you had your shot.
You heard the sermon, the guy passed through the village, you got it explained to you pretty clearly, but you stayed Buddhist.
Exactly. You had 20 minutes there, and when you really could have saved yourself from eternal damnation.
And you could have asked the question. You could have asked the question that was in your mind, but you did not raise your hand.
Right. And I realize that part of this comes down to this very ambiguous theology. At least I would maintain it's ambiguous. I mean, I know there are whole books written about it, but this idea of the Holy Spirit moving. But if there's, you know, if God has a role to play in it, then whether God chooses to move that, to have that spirit, is as integral to the salvation process, or perhaps more so, as John Piper would suggest, than whether that Japanese person has received enough information to make an informed decision.
Right, this whole idea of are you saved because you reach out in your hand to the life preserver, or are you saved because someone first gives you mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, waking you up enough that you can reach out to the life preserver?
Right.
Distinction between predestination and free choice.
Sure. And we could go around on this, as theologians have for thousands of years, of course. But obviously that the same situation, regardless of the amount of information available, pertains to me. That if I had received nothing but information on God and Jesus and Christ, and yet the Spirit did not move within me, then that is as much, that has to some degree be the result of God's agency as well as my own, you would think, unless you're a complete Arminian. And I guess it's funny, I said at the beginning of this conversation that I don't think the two views are at all separate, but how do you feel about that? Do you have a particular position on that issue that you rely on? Or that you consider that you prefer?
Yeah, I went through a period where I was strong Calvinist, and I very much understand the distinction, and I think it boils down to exactly what I said a few minutes ago about the crucial distinction is, are you able to reach out and make a choice, or does God change you such that the choice seems absolutely inevitable, and then you reach out and you make the choice?
Mm-hmm.
Such as, you know, you walk into a gorgeous cathedral and somebody asks you, Adam, what do you think of a cathedral? And you say the only thing you can say, it is breathtaking. I don't know quite how to describe it. I just need to sit here for a couple of hours and really soak it all in. As I think you did visit, judging by one of the postcards you sent me.
That is the most beautiful cathedral in the world, my friend, and it may actually also be just the most beautiful building in the world, yes.
That is a place that suddenly made itself onto my to-visit list once I saw just a little bit of the picture that was in the postcard.
I'm trying to remember the name. I'm glad to hear it. The Basilica de Sagrada Familia. It's the Basilica of the Sacred Family in Barcelona.
So I think the distinction between Arminianism and Calvinism is... Calvinism would say that you are unable to appreciate the beauty of the cathedral until God works a miracle in you, and then, of course, you accept the beauty of the cathedral. Whereas I think Arminianism would say you walk into the cathedral and you have a choice as to whether you think it is beautiful or whether you think it's just kind of okay, but not really that much to get excited about.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from that standpoint, there's a huge difference, because it's a question of, well, if you're going to hell, is it just because God hasn't worked that miracle in you? Or is it because you have consciously rejected the knowledge and the belief? And I went through a period where I was hardcore Calvinist, and now I'm back to a period where, I don't know, all of the Bible verses that everything is argued over, I can certainly see the curse of reading enough sci-fi. I can see both sides of almost anything, so it's hard to be really certain, really truly confidently certain of anything, since I can see both sides of everything.
And now I've forgotten, I think, what the original question was.
Oh, it was very much which side you fall on, Arminianism or Calvinism, as the schools are called. And you said you don't have a firm stance.
No, I don't, and that's also partly a result of reading enough C.S. Lewis over the years. C.S. Lewis's own views were somewhat idiosyncratic. And his view of hell seems to have been that it's the place you end up if you say God is at the center of the meadow and you turn around and start walking the opposite direction because you don't like what's at the center of the meadow. Where you end up is hell. And at a certain level, it's horrible because, as Lewis would say, it is a place of self-centeredness and selfishness and isolation. And so, almost in the sense that you have made your own hell. And Lewis also seemed to be of the viewpoint that you could worship God even if you didn't know the right names and the right labels to put on everything. And while I don't know that I agree with him 100%, I certainly find his writing persuasive, and I'm convinced that he was pretty confident about it. So... yeah, it's another one of those things where I think Christianity, when I was younger, and maybe bring this completely full circle, when I was younger, I was quite certain that I knew what Christianity was and how it worked. And now that I'm older, I'm quite certain that I know that a lot of people have very strong ideas about what Christianity is, and people over the past 2,000 years have argued almost every side of everything. And I am much less confident that I know what's going on.
Well, concerning C.S. Lewis, I think it's worth noting that, and I'm not taking personal offense at this, if only because we're in know you well and we're having open discussion here, but it's worth noting that what C.S. Lewis has really done there is slander people like me. He's ascribing motivations that you yourself do not ascribe to me in this podcast when we're discussing why or how I am walking and your opinion. And C.S. Lewis seems to think that essentially the further I have gone from Christianity, these are all attributable to vile instincts. And consequently, the less Christian I am, although how can you be less Christian? you know, I would think you either are or you aren't, the worse of a person I become.
Like I say, since C.S. Lewis's beliefs were idiosyncratic.
Yeah, I still appreciate his world-building skills, if nothing else. Yeah, okay. I guess that's all the questions I have, Joe. And I had no qualms whatsoever with spending a majority of this episode just asking you questions, because I think, ultimately, the answer, I don't believe in any of it, is less interesting than theology and winding your way through the Byzantine arguments of faith. But if thou hast any questions, proceed, sir.
Got quite a lot of questions. I saw some of your evolution on the blog as we wrote, and I was, I feel like, writing in a straight line along a path we had been on, and I saw you increasingly veering off in a different direction. And that raised questions at the time, but we didn't really have the ability to chat like we do now, so I never got to ask them. So I think now is my time to go back and ask all of the questions that I had then. But I'm looking at the clock. We've been talking for quite a while already, and I don't want to exhaust the patience of our listeners too much. So what do you say about picking this up next time and Joe quiz Adam?
Sounds good, Joe. Let's call it a night. Thanks for a good conversation.
All right. I look forward to talking to you next time then. Thanks, Adam.